Hello, and welcome to episode 119 of the Bulaq podcast. I'm Marsha Links Quayle, here today in Rabat, Morocco, and I'm joined, as always, by Ursula Lindsay in Brussels. We're also joined today to talk about Jordanian literature by Ibtihal Reda Mahmoud, who is the translator and co-editor of Snow in Amman, an anthology of short stories from Jordan, published in 2015. So hello, Ibtihal.
Hi, Marsha. Hi, Ursula.
Hi. So happy you could join us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
So for those of you who don't know her, Tahal is a writer, editor, translator, and poet, in addition to being the translator and co-editor of Snow in Amman. She's also the English translator of Yasin Ahej Saleh's The Impossible Revolution, Making Sense of the Syrian Tragedy, 2017. Her essays, translations, and criticism have appeared in The Markez, New Internationalist, Qantara, The Seattle Globalist, and Women Writer Women's Books. Her poetry and literary translations have been featured in international anthologies, including The Art of Being Human and others. She is a contributing editor to Arab Lit and very recently the managing editor of our My Ziyada project. Thank you again for that and for being here, Ibtihal.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Marsha.
So to start off, I think we would like to start through the lens of this anthology when talking about Jordanian literature more generally, this anthology that you put together, Snow in Amman. And I wonder if you could just start us off by walking through how you decided you wanted to do an anthology. How do you decide, you know, when doing an anthology of an entire national literature, what are you going to include? What are you not going to include? And your discussions with your co-editor, and if you could just start us off.
Oh, absolutely. So it started sometime in late 2013. I was actually inspired by another anthology that I came across not much earlier than that. It was Medina, an anthology that came out, I can't remember the year, but I came across that anthology and I thought, well, I've always wanted to do like a collection of short stories, and I wanted to work with Jordanian literature in particular for the longest time. So I thought, okay, enough thinking about it, now to the doing part. So I went. That time I was still active on Facebook. So basically I just posted an announcement on, there was a Facebook group that was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was something like the Jordanian Writers Union, or like an offshoot of the official Writers Union in Jordan. And I posted an announcement there that I'm putting together a collection of short stories that I intend on translating into English. And if anybody wants to contribute, this is my email. And I was not expecting that kind of response, honestly. The first person who responded was Samir Sharif. And he actually was very helpful. And shout out to Samir Sharif, who actually helped me put this together. He made sure that the announcement gets to as many people as possible. And he coordinated with getting me the the copyright agreements and all of that, and I started getting all these submissions from writers that I knew and writers I didn't know at the time. So that was an experience that I learned through also about writers in Jordan, because I left Jordan in 2010. In 2007. I visited in 2010, but I lived in 2007. So it had been a few years since I left. And for me, that was also a learning experience to know about all these writers that I never heard of before. It was like me going back to the roots somehow. So I went through all these submissions and it was overwhelming. Like, it was really hard to decide what to pick, what and not to pick. And it was sort of an unconscious decision, I guess, but as it turned out, like when I look through it, it feels like the majority of the works have the theme of femininity as a center theme. That was not intentional, but I think it just worked out that way.
Mm. And that's the case whether the writer is a man or a woman?
Yes, absolutely. And that was a nice surprise to me as well, because especially with the work of Ilyas Fakhour, the way he talked about the encounter with the story that we picked for the anthology was actually it was a chapter from a novel. And just the way that he experimented with themes of femininity and masculinity and how that works out in a misogynistic culture, I was delightfully surprised. Like, this is the kind of stuff that you would expect from a woman feminist most of the time, but he did justice to the topic in a way that was great. So that's just an example. And a lot of stories in the collection actually work that way as well.
Mm. So did you, when you were thinking about what to include, were you focused on making sure you had the sort of canon of Jordanian writers like Ilyas Fakhour, or were you more focused on the piece itself standing as, an excellent piece of literature?
Basically, I wanted to include some of the canonical names like Ilyas Fakhour and Bas Mansour, but I also wanted to include names that are emerging or were emerging at that time. But yes, absolutely. The main focus was on the piece itself and how it fits into the collection and whether or not it can lend itself to translation, because, you know, not every work can be translated easily. Sometimes we have to make a very hard decision on what to include, because sometimes the work is just too embedded in something like the culture or the linguistics of it cannot lend themselves easily to translation. So, yes, the focus was on the piece itself, the main focus.
And if you were, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to say, did you have help or was it just you reading and selecting?
So I did the selection and the translation, and my friend Alexander Haddad, I invited him later to be the editor because I needed an editor, and he's an excellent writer and editor. So he worked with the pieces that were already translated as the editor of the collection.
Huh. But did Samir play some role? Because Samir wrote the foreword as well, right?
He did, yes.
And did he play any role in what you decided to include?
I mean, in a way he did, because those were the works that he passed on to me as suggestions for inclusion in the collection. So I don't know if he... I don't know if he actually had to make selections on his part to pass on to me, but that's possible, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, so you grew up in Amman, but you had left and were living elsewhere when you worked on this collection. And it's a city that, in my experience, I lived there for 5 years until last year, is expanding and changing very, very quickly. So mm-hmm. Did you find already from reading the stories that there were like sides or views on the city or the country that in any way were like new or surprised you?
Well,
or was it more it reminded you of things actually that were part of like that you did remember and that it felt like there was a sort of, recognition?
Yeah, I think it was more of the latter, actually, because I mean, the majority of the stories don't have like a particular geographical location, except maybe the story by Bas Mansour, which explicitly takes place in Aqaba. But the majority of the stories do not point exactly where they take place, but it's just implied somehow that they are in Amman. And a lot of the ideas that the stories wrestle with are kind of like they're not explicitly trying to like point out to the relationship between the character and the setting, the geographical setting. It's more of an abstract language. A lot of times it would be like just focusing on the psychology or the struggle or the inner struggle or the monologue of the characters. A lot of characters in those stories have we see them having a lot of monologues and just focusing on their situation, but not so much the relationship with their surroundings so much. So there wasn't a lot of like the city was not prominent in that setting, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
So it's a very interior landscape.
Exactly. Yes.
Huh. Yeah, I guess, you know, the this literary works that I can think of that are contemporary literary works that really depict Amman. There are not so many of them. Like Ma'an Abu Talib's All the Battles definitely shows you different sides of Amman. Mm-hmm. But we there are a lot of...
Maya Abu al-Hayat has a whole section that's her memories of her childhood growing up there. In what's the 80s, 90s?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the ones that I can think of are actually by Palestinian authors, or even some Syrian authors setting their books in Jordan. And that's, I mean, I think that's one of the really interesting aspects of Jordanian literature. I can't think of any other country where people say so-and-so is a Jordanian-Palestinian writer or Palestinian-Jordanian writer, that there's a kind of an overlap identity there, like Ibrahim Nasrallah, Huzaima Habayib, like a number of prominent writers are associated both with Palestinian literature and with Jordanian literature.
Yeah, that is true. And also, I think since 2001, 2003, with the influx of, you know, with everything that was going on at the time around in the region, and people come in from, a lot of people had to go to Jordan from Iraq and from Syria, from Lebanon. And I think that kind of contributed to that mosaic of you know, perspectives in literature. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot of writers who are originally from other parts of the so-called Arab world who situate their work in Amman, because that was part of their experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of the literary history of Jordan. Both that it is the closest country geographically and in other ways to Palestine. I mean, just and it's so much. So many of the people who live there are originally from Palestine and came either in 48 or in 67 or at other times, and that it's a country that has had huge waves of refugees, and that began as a country of immigration. Certainly the city of Amman did, and where, like, you know, people from all across the region are represented.
Yeah, that is true. And actually, I can speak personally about that, because both my parents were originally from Palestine. And my dad's family settled or moved first to Kuwait and then settled in Jordan in 1990. But my mom's family went and moved to Jordan from Palestine sometime in the 70s. Like shortly after 1967, because they had to move to Jordan at that time. So both my parents are actually Palestinian Jordanians. And like I told you before we started, Ursula, I was actually born in Kuwait. But then we moved in 1990 after the Gulf War to Jordan. Mm. We settled in Jordan. So at the time I was very little. I didn't understand what was happening. But I could feel some sort of tension, I want to say. And I didn't understand it back then. I just thought maybe because we're the new kids in town, you know, this is just normal. But as I grew up, I realized that at that time, I think that the memory of some unfortunate incidents that were not too far in history were still fresh in the national memory. Like I'm specifically talking about things like, you know, Al-Hilal al-Aswad.
Right. Black September.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't know that until many years later. Like that was actually a thing that happened and not too long before we settled in Jordan. So yes, I mean, by default, I think there are two nationalisms coexisting in Jordan at all times, Palestinian and Jordanian nationalisms that exist. And that kind of contributed to the literary scene in Jordan, But we also have to remember that Jordan, like writers in Jordan, have to function in a like in a heavily censored environment. So when they want to talk about their experiences, they have to find like very creative ways of saying what they want without actually saying it explicitly. And a lot of times I feel like they speak in symbols,
right,
about their experience. Like they don't name exactly what they're naming,
mm-hmm.
but they rely heavily on the understanding of the reader to just like be able to see between the lines and understand what they're getting at.
Right. I mean, I think there's a writer we wanted to all talk about in this episode because we all admire him, which is the poet and writer Amjad Nasser. And I haven't read as much of his poetry as I've read his novel that was translated into English, which is called Land of No Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, I find, at least in the novel, it's a political story. I mean, there's a political elements to the story, quite strong ones, but there is no explicit mention of like which country. It's very recognizable, but there's an ambiguity left about like the details and the location of the story, which I think works beautifully within the story. But there's both this like strong political current to the narration and this kind of like purposeful ambiguity about the explicit references.
Exactly. And that same thing also happens in his second novel, It Was the Rose. You can hear very clear echoes like where this is happening without actually naming the place where it's happening. And mind you that Amjad Nasser was writing from exile, like he was writing from London the entire time. So imagine someone who's actually living in Amman at the time who wanted to get a little too political. It would be a dilemma because like I said, there's a lot of censorship. There's heavy censorship in the literary scene in Amman. So writers, to my knowledge, have not tried to rock the boat too hard. But they try to find creative ways of saying what they want. So a lot of times I feel like the symbolism, the language that they use, relies on the understanding of the recipient, the reader, and just trusting their intelligence to be able to decipher what they're trying to get at.
Which must present a challenge for translation then, because if the writer is relying on the reader sort of being able to read them on this second level of getting connotations, then that must also be a challenge when your reader is someone halfway across the world who maybe doesn't get the references.
That is correct. So that leaves the translator at a dilemma. Do I explain this, or do I just leave it as is? Because I think it depends on the reader's geographical situation and background and history to understand or not understand. So what about people who don't necessarily have like a background that like a shared background where they understand, oh, I know what he's talking about here. But that's not always the case. So for translation, that becomes a little difficult of a question to answer. Like, do I put a footnote here? Do I put a note here? Do I explain this? Or do I just leave it as is?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think with Land of No Rain, as I remember, it was translated by Robin Mosher, and that he did just leave things to the, you know, to the reader to figure out, now we're in London, now we're back in Amman. Although, I mean, to me, all of that was fairly straightforward.
Just to be clear, it was translated by Jonathan Wright.
It was translated by Jonathan Wright.
That's okay. True. Just mixed up two brilliant translators. Totally fine. I just, I had a feeling it might be that. it's a great book, but it works. I think in that case, the book's sort of like non-explicitness actually kind of gives it a little bit of a universality. Like it could, it's a story of this exiled dissident who's returning home to a like more or less repressive regime and context where he doesn't seem to know all the rules. And that can work. I mean, that kind of story is happening in a lot of different places at a lot of different times.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because the one piece by Amjad Nasser, which was, of course, not his name, but a pen name, that I can think of where it is so intensely place-based is his poetry collection, Petra, that I believe was composed for a museum, for a museum publication. And it was translated to English by Fe Di Giuda. And it is absolutely gorgeous. I have not ever been to Petra.
What?
It's true. I've been to Amman several times. I've never made it to Petra.
That makes two of us, Marcia.
Really? Yeah. Well, there you are. But I felt almost as if from reading this, the unfolding of this poem or series of poems that move around Petra historically and in the present, that I have experienced it. So I thank Amjad for that.
Well, maybe someday you can treat yourself to going there with the collection and revisiting it while you reread it. I visited a couple times and I had the very good luck because I was living in Jordan during COVID. The first time I went there was just as things were reopening and the place was practically empty. And it is an extraordinary, of course, as you know, like place on earth. Mm. I hope you get a chance to go there.
Yeah, we should plan that trip together, Marcia.
You should.
Yes, we should. We should.
Totally should. We want to read something by Amjad Nasser, and we also want to read something from the anthology. So what should we read first?
I will go ahead and read a poem by Amjad, translated by Sinan Antoine. And I would just say Amjad was also just such a lovely person and that we miss him very much. If you are passing through Rome, since you will not strike roots in the earth and will not lean like a willow to a brook, what use are these glances you cast, at times fierce, blank at others, but imploring in the end? You will only catch what appears by mistake, the hand under the table or a face that looked back unintentionally. It is not with a glance alone, no matter how long, concentrated, or even Medusan, that you, who are passing through Rome, can change the ways of Romans. This is not a cardboard decor that will crumble under your sweeping glance. Touch it with your hand to believe that reasons gather at times in an idiotic laugh or a shirt with figures. You have no knowledge as to why that woman, who is passing by like a long gasp, is holding on to that man who appears so unattractive to you. Oh, how that bulky man leans on the woman who could fly away with a breeze. It is not with the glance alone, no matter how trained, piercing, and intense, that you could stir the sugar spoon in her coffee. For you alone believe that lowering an eyelash or a knight bending down can barter a life of flesh and blood. So when your glances return crestfallen, do not say that it is money, fame, or even luck. The one passing through does not leave a tattoo on an arm or a scar on a chest. But remember that reasons have gathered themselves for you in another Rome with one word. You do not know how it was revealed to you, nor how you uttered it, because the glances cast upon the one who fell in your arms with a full load of her lavender have gone astray.
That was so beautiful.
Yeah,
I want to say something about Amjad. I have to say this because I feel like I've never met him in person, but we were sort of like online friends, but our friendship only began in January 2018. So that was less than 2 years before he passed away. But I consider myself very lucky to even have that short interaction with that amazing figure. Basically, one day that was back when I was active on social media. I posted something on Twitter, and I found him on Twitter, and I just followed him, you know, like just the way that people follow public figures on Twitter. And then to my surprise, shortly after, he followed me back, and then he sent me a direct message and said, "What's your email? I want to send you a copy of my latest novel, Here's the Rose, and a collection It hasn't been translated. It's called Shaka Aknoma and Hayra, the poppies of puzzlement or something of sorts. How would you translate it, Marcia?
You'd have to give me a minute.
Okay. I think something like poppy seeds of
bafflement, I guess.
Bafflement, yeah. Or puzzlement, or yes. So that was actually just like a collection of selections from other collections of his put together. And I couldn't believe it. Like, someone of that sort of fame and magnitude is actually so humble and like sending me his work. And to me, I felt like I was entrusted with something very valuable and very precious. And so I took my time reading that novel. And if you remember, Marcia, I reached out to you in February of 2018, and I said I wanted to write a review of this novel. And his response to the review was just amazing. I mean, he wrote like a very long post on Facebook, if you remember, thanking me for that review. I was almost crying. Like, who am I? I don't deserve this. I really don't. Like, this is coming from Amjad Nasser. Do you know who this is? And so when a year later he announced that his illness was terminal, it was very hard for me to hear that. Like, I heard it when I was at work, and I was just like bawling my my eyes. My colleagues saw me, and they were like a little scared to just lift me.
I mean, I'm sure there must have been so many people who felt. I also felt like that. I think he probably reached out to me very soon after Arablit was launched. In a similar way, just kind of messaged me, "Hi, I'm Amjad Nasser." Very humble, and of course, many people want to promote their work, but not in a promotional way. Just like, let's have a conversation about literature, kind of way. I also was very, mournful, struck when he passed.
Yeah. And the thing is, his last collection, which came out shortly before he passed, Mamlakat Adam, Adam's Kingdom, I actually wanted to write a review about it while he was still alive, but he passed away suddenly. Suddenly. And it took me about a year to, like, look at it again and write the review. Because I wanted it to be out there so bad when he was still alive to just, like, honor the work that came out at the time. But it took me about a year later to get myself to write it.
Wow. You've translated some of his poems?
I did not. I only wrote a review of Here's the Rose and Adam's Kingdom.
Other than there's still quite a bit of his work that remains to be translated into English, right?
Yeah, and you know, thinking back, he did send me that collection, Shaka Aknoma and Hayra. And now I think about it, maybe I should do something with it. That was something that he gave to me. So maybe I should work on that at some point.
That sounds lovely. Yeah. Yes, I mean, as I guess we all know, publishing does skew towards the translation of works by living writers. So, it becomes harder to pitch. But he is a writer of such stature and talent and beauty that I'm sure that it can find a home.
I mean, I would love for there to be more of his work available in translation.
I absolutely agree.
And then speaking of some of the other writers who you have translated and who you have included in Snow in Amman, do these also include authors who were translated into English for the first time, or who haven't had much of their work translated into English before?
Yes, the majority of the writers were actually never translated before, but people like Ilyas Farkouh and Bas Mansour, they have already been translated. Some of their works, I don't think there's like a substantial volume of their works that's available in English, but
I don't think either one has a book translated to English, even Elias Farkuh.
That's right.
And but Basma, definitely not.
No, she's not.
Which is a shame.
Absolutely. And I would love to see like a book length translation of both of their works because they're amazing writers.
So let's share a bit more about Basma Almsur with the listeners. What can you tell us about her?
Yeah, so I have a little story I want to tell about Basma Almsur and how I first came to know that there's a writer named Basma Almsur, how her name entered my psyche for the first time. So a little bit of background information. That was back in the early 90s. My mom had a tradition of lining the dining table with old newspapers. You know, we invented recycling before it was cool. So we would sit down and have dinner, and the table would be lined with old newspapers. And I was reading as I was eating with my family. There was a page from Jarida al-Dustur, which is one of the official newspapers in Jordan, and there was a piece about Basma Almsur where she described herself as Hassan Sabi, which is sort of like the Arabic equivalent of a tomboy. She said that when I was a child, I used to be a tomboy. And that name just stuck with me since then. I was a child in middle school back then. And when I started putting together the works out, the works for Snow and Amman, I absolutely wanted her to be part of this. And so it was like revisiting a memory from my childhood, doing collecting stories.
And are you going to read part of the story for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So this is from The Brass Coal Pot by Basma Almsur. Excuse me, you're sitting in my seat. To be perfectly honest, I had no idea that my ticket came with an assigned seat. I fumbled for an apology, overwhelmed with embarrassment, and made to leave. But now the young man, who was also showing some uneasiness about the whole situation, offered to leave his seat in exchange for mine. A kind gesture, but of course I refused. I would not say so, but I thought it best that a man like this, so genial and accommodating, deserves this seat above all others, since the one next to it was occupied by a beautiful young lady. It was a long journey ahead, and in that time, they could come to know one another, perhaps become friends or even lovers. Who knows? I imagine the two of them ending up in a happy marriage, the kind in which they would reflect contentedly from time to time on the circumstances which brought them together, a story which, in their telling, would see me playing my part over and over again, humbly and namelessly, but always assigned the proper degree of gratitude.
Huh. Are we stopping there?
No, I'm skipping a few paragraphs.
Okay, because I'm in suspense. I want to know what happens next. It's a good premise. I'm like launched.
Just a few minutes before the bus was scheduled to depart, the last passenger boarded. He was a somber-looking man, the kind whose expression of sullen disgust seemed so practiced as to be effortless, maybe even permanent. Without so much as a word, he threw his body brusquely into the seat next to mine. I barely had time to snatch up my purse before he sat on it. It was clear to me that this man had no idea how to treat a lady, so I ignored him as best as I could, which is to say, I fidgeted in distress, checked my watch, dropped my purse between my feet, then picked it up again, settled it in my lap, and proceeded to sift aimlessly through its contents. All the while, my neighbor's countenance expressed the deepest resentment. I tried to sit still. "Your eyes are amazingly beautiful," he had said in a voice that reflected some sort of defeat as it uttered those words, the words that installed themselves in the forefront of my memory for a whole year. "Your eyes are amazingly beautiful." My scowling seatmate, who must have noticed the change in my expression, shifted his eyes toward me. In sudden bewilderment, I needed no more invitation than this. Shall we go on?
No, I think, you know, what's one of the things that's really compelling to me about Basma Nasur is her, how, you know, sort of both how she takes apart gender relations, right? But, and also the sort of observancy and like the sharpness of her tongue. I wonder what, you know, if you could talk a little bit about what has attracted you to her writing.
Exactly what you just described. I think that she talks about gender relations in a way that is very appealing to me. She's not afraid to talk about feminist issues in a way that might be upsetting to some. But just like in, like, for example, in that story that I read from, the story goes on and she tells us about the character and how it turns out that she was a what people would call a spinster. But she went all the way to Aqaba because a year ago she had an encounter with a shopkeeper in Aqaba who told her that her eyes are beautiful. And then a year later, she goes on this search for that man, she was basically naive in a way, but at the same time, I like how she gave the character the will and the agency to act in a way that might be foolish to some, but she actually acted on her own accord, like, especially for a woman to just go seek a man. This is so untraditional, unconventional. It doesn't end well in the story, but just the fact that she gave the character that sort of ability to act on her own accord, I like that a lot. And I could feel that in a lot of her works as well.
I don't think they usually end well.
No.
there's this story that she wrote called That Pathetic Woman. It was Thoreya Reyes, our friend Thoreya Reyes, translated it for Arablit for our anti-Valentine's Day posting. And this one, I do feel it's a happy ending, although of course it's a bitter happy ending. The last paragraph, it's told from the point of view of the other woman. After the guy died, she goes to visit his grave. And the final paragraph is, "I put flowers on your grave. I wonder if you know how it feels now to live in the dark, alone, powerless, left behind. It's all right, darling. Don't worry. I'll be back to visit you. I'll always bring flowers and tell you about life outside that dark grave. I'll share all my intimate moments with you, open up everything that is in my soul to you. Then I will leave you again and again and again." So
oh,
that's
wow.
Kind of happy. That's, I mean, kind that's, of happy.
No, Marcia, that is a particularly twisted definition of a happy ending. I really don't think it's meant to be read as,
it's
like,
very
as a happy person feeling happy.
Well, but is okay, but as Ibn Tahal says, she gives this woman agency.
Oh, so yeah.
She's like a woman who's like stuck. Actually, maybe that's another thing that really appeals to me about Basma Nasur's stories, which is that this woman stuck in a kind of a role, right? She's like relegated to the darkness, as she says, you know, to the margins repeatedly in the story. But she kind of, she puts herself center stage, and she, from the very limited array of options that stand in front of her, she will go back to that grave, you know, tell the guy about other love stories, and then leave. She decides that she gets to leave him now. So, you know, she gets something.
I love the sarcasm of it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that.
No, it's a good final twist. She gets to be the one telling the story too. That's all.
That's true. She's the one narrating the story, and he's dead. So,
yeah. happy ending. there's one book that I wanted to talk about, but unless there's more that we want to say now about some of the writers we've discussed so far, But maybe it'll work in conversation with them too.
Yeah, go ahead, jump in.
All right. Well, so, you know, when I was living in Amman, I was looking often for things written about the city or from Jordan or connected to where I was, because that's always, you know, interesting. And at some point, somebody told me that Abdurrahman Munif, who I thought of as a Saudi writer, had grown up in Amman and written this book called Sirat al-Medina, so the story of the city, about his childhood in Amman in the 1940s. It is available in Arabic pretty easily and very much out of print in English, unfortunately, I think. Again, speaking of the need for like new editions or new translations or so on. There is a beautiful English translation, but it's not easy to find. And someone very kindly sent me a PDF from a university library. And it is, to me, this fascinating, very detailed account of the city that he grew up in the 1940s. The opening, which, it starts out from the point of view of a child, and it starts out with this moment, which is the first moment in which this child realizes that the sort of limits of his neighborhood and his family and the people he know are not the limits of the world, because this historical event happens. It's the death of King Ghazi in Iraq, who was the nephew of the King of Jordan. The two families are branches of the same family. And there's a huge funeral procession in Amman. So people are leaving their homes and going downtown and joining this procession. And the child also leaves his home, his neighborhood, and sees for the first time kind of the bigger city. And also, interestingly enough, so, you know, sort of the bigger community, right? Because this is a sort of national moment. So it's a very interesting, I think, sort of opening point for this story, because it's the point at which like this child sort of realizes the much larger boundaries of like the city he's part of and the nation he's part of, which is this incredibly like mixed community. Speaking, you know, we talked about how this Jordan has been home to people from so many different places. When he describes in the first chapter like his childhood and his neighborhood, his grandmother's from Baghdad and his neighbor is from Nablus. And he mentions, you know, Bedouins from Karak and Madaba, and a doctor who's Greek and a doctor who's Armenian. And it's just this like long list of people from all over. And these are just the people living right in his neighborhood. So there's a real emphasis on this kind of early cosmopolitanism of the city. And if you want, I have a passage I can read.
Please do.
Okay. So the first impression that a tourist passing through Amman during the 1940s, and no doubt there must have been many, would have had was that the city was experiencing a constant carnival because of the variety in costumes, accents, and traditions was greater than anywhere else. For example, in one of the side streets off Mango Street, elderly women from Fuhais used to set up their long water pipes at least twice a day in the late morning and before sunset. These pipes, which were each longer than a meter, would be packed with coarse tobacco and lit, and the women would begin to talk to each other as they watched the road, throwing pebbles at the chickens if they got too close. From time to time, they felt the huge black cloaks hanging on the clotheslines. One always wondered how many layers those cloaks formed when they were worn, particularly when one saw them taking up such huge spaces on the clotheslines. On the same side street, there was a small school run by two sisters, Miss Alice and Miss Margot. They wore the latest European fashions, and English was the language spoken at the school. Not far from the school and the water pipes in both directions, tall, lean Circassians in kolpaks could be found in addition to several accents, the Nablusi, the Damascene, the Najdi, in addition to the Armenian Arabic accent, which was relatively rare but present on that street, as it was on other streets. On that particular street, it was represented by the Armenian photographer, Reuben. Whatever direction one went in, one encountered several different phenomena. Despite this, the souks, particularly the vegetable markets, were a place of convergence. Because Amman was small and had few inhabitants at that time, many people, if not all, knew one another or had at least met several times in different places. There's much, much more in terms of observations of what the early city was like, and some of it perhaps a bit idealized. But he says, you know, that there was, because it was sort of like a settlement, like people coming there very early on. So all these different communities actually had to get along and had to find solutions to things and had to make things work. And so his vision of it is very positive.
Interesting, because when I think about the multiplicity of cultures in Jordanian literature, I think about beginning with the Nakba and with 1967 and the Iraqis who came and the Syrians who came. But
it goes back further.
Right.
So actually, there was a Roman settlement and, different moments the city was settled, but it had basically been completely abandoned. And then it was resettled in 1878, I want to say, by Circassian communities that were part of the Ottoman Empire, to the point where there's a neighborhood in Amman called El Muhajirin, the immigrants, that's like from one of the waves of Circassian settlement early on. People were coming in. It was a new city. Then they had a station on the Hejaz Railway. And so once they created a station on the Hejaz Railway line, it became a place where like merchant families came. And like, of course, there was also the colonial elements. It was, under British control until the 20s and arguably later. It was a kind of frontier town. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And something similar happened, Ursula, with the arrival of Chechenian immigrants. There's actually a neighborhood in Amman. It's called Sueleh.
Uh-huh.
And it's predominantly Chechen residents who identify as Jordanian at the end of the day, but they still like hold on to their Chechenian heritage and language, and they actually only speak their native language at home to their children. But they still hold on to their traditions, and they actually have like a Chechenian festival every year in Jordan, as far as I remember, where they do their traditional dance in their traditional garments. It's beautiful.
Oh, how cool. Yeah, I mean, you see communities that really are distinct and attached, and they have certain neighborhoods that basically sprung up around their arrival and like maybe particularly anchored in like certain professions or whatever. But I mean, it's one of the things that I think made the city super interesting. I mean, all that's not to sort of like gloss over. I think this early, almost egalitarian ethos that he talks about in the novel, you know, the city that I knew, it was like a very segregated city, socioeconomically segregated. Like it became a much, much bigger city, and there's an east and a western side, and there's a core, and there's these like very affluent suburbs, and it's an entirely different entity. But it was so cool to read about, because the places that he talks about is less than a century ago, and they're all like recognizable locations right at the heart of town. Of course, he's writing at the time when like the river still ran through the center of Amman, the river that's now been covered. But you know where it is. I just loved sort of seeing, reading about all these places that you can still trace.
Mm. It would be great to have a sort of a literary walking tour where, somebody would take you through Amman and show you these different sites.
Yeah, maybe there is. Well, I don't know. I mean, yes, that'd be great. There were tours of like graffiti and art spaces and things like that, but I don't know of a literature one. Mm. Do you?
Not me. I know like Rim Basyuni does them of Cairo, but I don't know of one in Amman.
No. Well, yet another project that should be done. I think we missed it. Like, so you guys are going to Petra. We need to put out more translations. We need to reissue this book and have a walking tour of Amman to go along with it. All of these seem like excellent ideas to me.
And also, I'm going to put together a Jordan issue of the publisher's newsletter so that we can better inform foreign language publishers about Jordanian literature and what things that they should be interested in publishing.
Great.
Yeah, so far we've nominated Ilyas Fakur and Bas Mansour for...
And more books by Amjad Nasser.
More books by Amjad Nasser, absolutely. And also I want to say Ghalib Halassa, if I had to add another recommendation. This recommendation actually comes from my late friend Khalid Khalifa. One time we were talking about Jordanian literature, and he actually suggested that I work with some texts by Ghalib Halassa for translation. I haven't done that yet, but that's just something that I wanted to mention.
So was he specifically referring to Sultana or something else?
He didn't specify what work exactly, but he just likes Ghalib Halassa and his work.
I mean, his name came up again and again. Yeah. But Sultana, there is not an available English translation. Is that right?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, me neither. All right. Well, we will be
listening. I just want to say that it is strange, like among the works of sort of literary canon of modern Jordanian literature, There's a list that was put out, you know, by the Arab Writers Union. They made a list of 105 important novels of the 20th century at the beginning of the 21st century. And none of the Jordanian ones have been translated. Some, you know, other countries have, you know, done more to kind of, well, you know, more. It's just surprising with the number of translators who I assume have moved through Amman that more Jordanian literature is not available in translation.
Hmm. Yeah. So for the professional newsletter that we're going to.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. We have time to get cracking. Mm-hmm. People need to get on this.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, you've already led the way, Ibtihal, and we will be including links in the show notes to all of the books we talked about and, of course, to your anthology. And we want to thank you again I know you're in constant communication with Marsha. For me, this is the first time that we get the chance to talk, and it's been a pleasure. So thank you so much.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you. And I want to say thank you, Marsha, because I just want to say that Arablit has always felt like a home to me. Like when I started writing literary criticism, the first place I published a work of mine was Arablit. So it will always have like a very special place in my heart.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for everything that you've done, especially with this new My Ziyada book. We would not have been able to bring it together without you.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, I think that wraps it up. Take care. Talk to you soon.
All right.
All right. Thanks to everyone for listening. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Subscribe to Bulak wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bulak Books and Instagram at Bulak.books for news and updates. Please rate or review us, and if you'd like to support us, you can make a donation on our page on DonorBox. Bulak is produced in collaboration with the podcast platform SOWT, S-O-W-T, which produces many other excellent shows in Arabic on music, literature, media, and more. For all things related to Arabic literature and translation, you should visit arablit.org, where you can also subscribe to the Arablit Quarterly. If you are interested in advertising on Bulak or sponsoring episodes, contact us at bulak@sout.com. All the links and addresses mentioned here are in the show notes.